The scripture is taken from Jeremiah 31, verses 27 to 34. The time is coming, declares God, when I will plant seeds in Israel and Judah, and both people and animals will spring up, just as I watched over them, to dig up and pull down, to overthrow, destroy, and bring harm. So I will watch over them, to build and plant, declares God. In those days, people will no longer say, sour grapes eaten by parents leave a bitter taste in the mouths of their children, because everyone will die for their own sins. Whoever eats sour grapes will have a bitter taste in their own mouth. The time is coming, declares God, when I will make a new covenant with the people of Israel and Judah. It won't be like the covenant I made with their ancestors when I took them by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt. They broke that covenant with me, even though I was their husband, declares God. No, this is the covenant that I will make with the people of Israel after that time, declares God. I will put my instructions within them and engrave them on their heart. I will be their God, and they will be my people. They will no longer need to teach each other to say, know our God, because they will all know me, from the least of them to the greatest, declares God. For I will forgive their wrongdoing and never again remember their sins. This is the end of the reading. Thanks be to God.
Thank you, Jean. So, you know, before I share anything with you all, I really want to say thank you. There are a number of professions in which sabbaticals are built into the job. Not many, though. The last Sunday I was here, Frances was our lector, and she stood up and said that as a judge for 25 years, she had never once had a sabbatical. Didn't make me feel guilty at all. Judges should never make you feel guilty unless, in fact, you are. But indeed, this is a profession that has sabbaticals oftentimes built into the contract, and I am so grateful for the 10, 11, 12, 47 weeks, however long it was that I was gone, that you all gave to me. And so I really want to say thank you, and much of today's service is for me a way of saying mahalo for that gift. I did a lot of reading. Much of it, as I had said when I left, was in the area of Celtic spirituality, which really fascinates me, and you'll probably hear some of that come out in upcoming sermons, and maybe a little today, who knows. But it took me in different directions, and it took me to doing some writing. I had thought I would do some writing while I was on sabbatical, but the writing ended up taking its own form and structure, some of which is still trying to find its way, so I'm trying to find pockets of time to keep up with that. But mostly while on sabbatical, what I made a commitment to was to slow down. It was to slow down and do as best as I could to be aware and listen to the presence of God in my life. To listen for, as in the Celtic tradition, they say, the heartbeat of God, and allow that heartbeat to become my own as much as possible. And so I loved it when I come back, and the first Sunday that I'm back, the scripture that Jean just read for us is all about our hearts connecting with God's heart. Jeremiah says in this scripture that Jean just says, the day is going to come, preaching to the folks who are exiled in Babylon, the day is going to come, Jeremiah says, when I will reestablish, God says this, my covenant with you all. And that covenant will not be like the old covenant, a covenant that was written on stone. The covenant that the new covenant is going to be one that is written on your hearts. Written on your hearts. And when you think about that, in so many ways, that's a great definition for what spiritual life, a spiritual journey is all about, is to, whether it is as an individual or as a community, to live in such a way that our very heart, our very spirit, beats with the heartbeat of God. That is what defines our day in and our day out. Certainly, 2,000 years ago, when Jesus is teaching and preaching and healing and walking the streets of Palestine, walking the countryside of Palestine 2,000 years ago, that's a message that he was telling to his disciples and to all that he met, is that we need to be in sync with God. Certainly that first church, the first generation church, and the generations, those early generations that followed, that was the essence of what they were trying to proclaim to people. That spiritual journey that people were being called to was a journey in which we are trying to match our spirit with God's spirit, our heartbeat with God's heartbeat, that very presence with that greater presence. And when you think about it, when you think about the reality of that early church, it is utterly mind-boggling what they did. I mean, imagine the church starts with the execution of your teacher, your rabbi, executed as an enemy of the state, aided by the religious leaders of your very own community. And then 3 days later, followers claim that he has risen again. And what is amazing is they live with that as their truth. They live with that as their truth, and they lean not into fear, which they could be excused for leaning into fear, right? I mean, following this person who got killed might lead you to the same thing. And in fact, in that first couple of generations, to proclaim faith in this Jesus was a way to get yourself killed. They don't lean into fear. They instead lean into love. They lean into love in the very same way in which Jesus had lived with them. Their life becomes a life that is very much in the same way about the very healing that he was a part. Healing of physical bodies, healing of spirit, healing of communities, healing of families. That becomes a central point in all that the early church is gathering together. And just as with Jesus, there was absolutely no hierarchy in the way in which he gathered folks together, they begin to create community in such a way in which hierarchy is done away with. There is no hierarchy of gender. There is no hierarchy of wealth. There is no hierarchy of citizenship. Slave, free, male, female, Greek, Roman, Jew, it doesn't matter. There was no hierarchy. It is done away with. In a world in which was defined by hierarchy and patronage, this is an outrageous way to live. And in the same way, just as Jesus had a cloak and a pair of sandals to call his name and yet lived from a place of abundance, so too do they do. We read in the book of Acts that they share all that they have. All their possessions are shared together so that those who have the least are able to share from those who have the most. It's like that story of stone soup. Stone soup is being made everywhere they go. And amazingly, this little fellowship based upon a person who has been executed, begins to spread throughout the entire Roman Empire. Within a generation, wherever the Roman Empire is, there are people who are followers of the way. And not only are those people who are followers of the way, they are doing things in such a way that says this is a faith that is malleable, that is adaptable. Paul goes to Athens. He stands in Athens and he sees a temple, for the unknown God. And he says, let me tell you about the God that I know. Your unknown God is this God. And then they create different metaphors as a church is the vine, the body, all these things malleable, adapting to where the spirituality is of the people in which they are. Well, this is what happens when you sing in the very beginning. I need Chris to teach me voice control. And this little fellowship that is now spread around the world, not in great cathedrals, not in great temples, but in people's homes in which the best seats are reserved, not for the elite, but for those who are being called off the streets. This little group of people acts as if they really believe that what Paul says. Paul says, we're going to turn the world upside down, which means to turn it right side up. We're going to turn the world upside down. Paul had the audacity, and the followers in the first generations had the audacity to believe that they were indeed a counter to the way of the Roman Empire, its bludgeon of peace through the sword, its bludgeon of wealth for a few on the backs of many. And this little group, ragtag group of misfits, saw themselves as a challenge to that way of being. There's absolutely no reason why this group of folks was not snuffed out in one generation. And yet, they were not. And generation after generation, the church grows and grows until, amazingly, in the year 315 or so, Constantine, the emperor of Rome, decides that this faith which is founded by a person that the Roman Empire executed, shall now become the faith of the entire empire. A reversal of amazing proportions. And you can well imagine how the church leaders of the time must have been celebrating. But, you know, it may be one of those perfect examples that you better be careful what you wish for. Because this faith that began as a goad to the empire is now about to become a tool of the empire. That's what happens in that third century. In that third century, Constantine pulls together all the church leaders and everything else and says, here's the thing. You have one task. Calls them together in a place called Nicaea. I want you to codify the faith. I want you to codify the faith so that wherever you go in the empire, everyone will know, have the same faith, use the same words, have the same understanding, same terminology, same orientation, even though the empire is this big and people are that big and different. Codify it, unify it, make it one. And in the process, in order to do that, there are things that have to happen. One of those things is hierarchy returns. Hierarchy returns. Jesus, who could not even probably say the word hierarchy, his faith is now one in which from believer to priest to bishop to the emperor himself is now a direct line of those who are more and more and more important in the hierarchy. And theology gets developed. Original sin. Original sin comes to us from Augustine, and original sin says, basically, we are not born good and blessed, as it says in the Bible. Instead, original sin says, you're born corrupt, you're born sinful. You were born in such a way that unless something is done, you cannot be saved. And so the ones who have the power, the ones who have the power to, in fact, do something so you can be saved, now can act in a way in which they can do anything because the better good, the greater good is you being saved, and so they can run roughshod over your lives because, after all, you're a sinner to begin with. Not good, not blessed, you're a sinner to begin with, so I can do whatever works to make you come along. I know what you got for me. Thank you, Liz. And furthermore, if in fact, you don't want to come along for the ride, it's okay. We'll just kill you. We'll just take you out. We learned that in the 1950s and 60s when we heard phrases like better dead than red, right? Same theology, same philosophy. If you can't agree, we'll take you out. Because after all, you're corrupt to begin with. And that theology begins to be codified, begins to be written down into the laws that then become the way of the church. And 1,700 years later, the dominant theology of Christianity throughout much of the world is not a theology that is a theology of love, the one who in which we follow, but is instead a theology that has hierarchy built into it, has the fact that we are sinners built into it, not good and blessed, but that we begin as horrible and corrupt, bereft of God. And what we know is that when everything becomes codified, there is a danger. The danger is you better follow that way, and it leads to totalitarianism and authoritarianism within church, or it leads to what I call the loopholization of the world, in which we're just looking for ways to get through the law so we can do whatever it is that we want. Perfect example, when this was happening in Jesus' time, and you weren't supposed to travel from your soil on the Sabbath day, people would take dirt from where they were and put it in their pocket. Then they could travel. Loopholes. The exact opposite of what Jeremiah was saying 900 years before the Council of Nicaea, in which Jeremiah said, God is calling us with a new covenant that will be written on your hearts, not written on stone. There's nothing wrong with laws. We need them as a society. But we are called to not just live by those laws. We are called to a higher law that is that law that is written on our hearts, a law of love. And here at Church of the Crossroads, we are far from perfect. I hate to tell you that if you think you are. It's just a reality. But I do know that we try to live from that place primarily, a place of love, a place in which the song that we sang just a few minutes ago, no matter who you are, no matter where you are in life's journey, you are welcome here. That is the essence of who we are, and that sometimes puts us way out of step with the mainstream of our faith, which can be a tricky place to stand at times, but it is also, when we gather together, a very comfortable place. Like, you know, the folks in that early church, they loved gathering together in love with one another. So I thought, let's just take a moment. Let's just take a moment And let's bask in that gift of love. In the 1700s, in Moravia, I don't even know where it is, it's somewhere over there. Excuse me. In Moravia, it was decided that we remember that the early church gathered together for fellowship primarily, and they gathered around the table, and the tradition began to make sure that food became a part of our fellowship, because it's around the table in that fellowship where we enjoy one another and hear one another, can hear the very heartbeat of God beating with one another. And so they began the tradition of what's known as the Moravian Love Feasts. And Moravian Love Feasts are simply, they have these wonderful sweet buns and coffee and tea that get served to everybody in the middle of the church. So I thought, let's do that. So today we've been baking. And if you turn around, you're going to see a whole bunch of young people with food that we have baked. And here's what I'm going to ask you to do. The folks in Zoom land, in just a little bit, we're going to send you off to breakout rooms. We're going to send you to breakout rooms for 10 minutes or so to chat and be with one another. You all who are here, I'm going to invite you to turn your chairs. We don't have pews. What a gift. No pews. Turn your chairs. Turn and make groups of 4, 5, 6. We'll bring you some food. Don't do it just yet. Let me give you your instructions. I just love how people are just eager to do it. And we've got some folks that are probably here for their first or second time. Make sure you welcome everyone here. Spend time talking with one another. And if you run out of things to say, I've got a couple of questions. One of the questions is very simply, if the law that is written in our hearts is the law of love, how do you see it lived out? And secondly, if all of us are unique, but we are all called to be one, how do we unify without forcing conformity? That's the real challenge in a church based on love.